From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just a couple of months ago when a young family arrived finally in Rochester. A mother, a father, a young child, a baby born just a few months before. The woman named Frohar was here on an SIV, a special immigrant visa, granted to her for her work in Afghanistan. When the Taliban came back to power, women were forced to stop working, to stop going to school, to stop going out in public without a man to supervise them. And you might have seen a recent headline on NPR and the New York Times, the Taliban in a message to Western democracies is essentially saying, stay out of our affairs. They are vowing to publicly stone women to death for adultery and other crimes, saying that women's rights violate their interpretation of Sharia law. Worse, Afghans who work with the United States government were being targeted by the Taliban and some being killed. They were viewed as traitors. And Frohar knew that her entire family could soon be in danger, and so they tried to get out. For nearly 2 years, they were in Cyprus. And then every time it seemed like they had a ticket to the United States, something would stop them. A local organization called Keeping Our Promise was trying to bring Frohar's family here. Executive Director Ellen Smith has said that the ordeal was like a movie script. And now they might finally wonder if they can have a happy ending. But for countless Afghan women and girls, there is little hope under the Taliban. Keeping Our Promise has a big annual event coming up, and we're going to talk about that this hour. And we're honored to be joined, as always, by Ellen Smith, Executive Director of Keeping Our Promise. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan, and the WXXI audience for having us.
And welcome to Frohar Askarzada. Frohar is a teacher who has now escaped Afghanistan, settled here on an SIV with her husband and baby Omar, who's just a few months old. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You have a beautiful family.
Thank you so much.
And the baby is hanging around here somewhere, so he's probably listening, or maybe napping, we hope. Probably napping.
Maybe napping.
Welcome as well to Dr. Nadia Hashimi. Dr. Hashimi is on the line with us, a pediatrician and author, a member of the U.S. Afghan Women's Council and the Afghan American Foundation. Dr. Hashimi, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having this conversation.
Ellen Smith, this is your first chance to talk to Dr. Hashimi, but Dr. Hashimi is going to be an important part of the event coming up here.
Yes, I heard Dr. Hashimi on an NPR program, and I was like, it would be wonderful to have her at our gala and speaking on behalf of Afghan women. And I am just so honored, Dr. Hashimi, that you are going to be joining us, and you're joining us here today, and thank you so much.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to it. I think this is, you know, the theme of this event, this resilience is so poignant right now, because that's exactly what we are seeing yet again, demonstrated by these Afghan families who have arrived here, and as well by the Afghan women and the Afghan families who are still in Afghanistan and now dealing with the Taliban's rule.
Well, and in a moment, we're going to hear Frohar's family story, but I want to kind of key in on the point that Dr. Hashimi is making, and I'll start with you, Ellen. You know, when we talked a couple of years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago now, that the Taliban came back to power, was that 2021? And, you know, at the time, some of the Taliban leaders were saying things publicly that, well, this was going to be different, they would respect women, that people didn't have to stop working. It did not take long for that to be exposed as a lie, and it wasn't a surprise that that was a lie. But now, I mean, look how far they have come. I mean, the headline on NPR here, Taliban vowing to publicly stone women to death in a kind of rebuke to Western democracies who are trying to intervene. How do you see the situation?
Evan, we talked about it before the fall of Afghanistan. And when President Trump was making the agreement called the Doha Agreement with the Taliban, all of our families saw this coming. And they kept saying, you can't trust the Taliban. This isn't going to happen. They saw their country, our SIV friends saw their country going backwards. And I know that people complain about the agreement that was made. It was made by former President Trump. It was upheld by President Biden. But I like to point out to this agreement that we signed on to, that we agreed to a timeline for withdrawal of Afghanistan. It was originally May 2021. That was extended under the Biden administration to September. But part three, number three of that Doha agreement says the United States will refrain from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of Afghanistan or intervening in its domestic affairs. So we really have no say on girls going to school, women finishing the university and becoming doctors or teachers. We have no say in whether or not women are stoned to death under their interpretation of Sharia law.
Mm. Dr. Hashimi, there was never really any doubt, I don't think, that this iteration of the Taliban would look like the first iteration. What have you noticed in the last couple of years that you want our listeners thinking about?
I think you're exactly right. What we are seeing playing out right now is a repeat of what happened when the Taliban were in power in 1996 to 2001. The heartbreaking part right now is that the generation that's living in Afghanistan was raised. It's a very young population, right? So the generation that's living there right now are people who had opportunities, are boys and girls who went to schools where they would see, boys would see their sisters go to schools, would see their mothers have the opportunity to be entrepreneurs, to have jobs outside of the home, to be in government, and all of that vanished overnight. And so what's really devastating is to get messages like the ones I've received from young women in Afghanistan saying, I feel like I'm being buried alive, because they no longer have the ability to go to school. They no longer have a future to look forward to. What do you do with your life if you cannot work outside of the home, if you're expected to be closeted within the four walls of your family's dwelling, and there's really no light that comes in to say that there's a future beyond?
Well, and Dr. Hashimi, I was eavesdropping on a little online class with 10, 11, 12-year-olds recently. My son was part of the class, so I was allowed to eavesdrop, I think. And there was a discussion in the class. Kids were asking about how power is wielded. And some of the kids were asking, you know, if most human beings yearn to be free, yearn to have their own choice and their own independence and self-determination, why is it that we see authoritarian power? Why do we see rights taken away when the number of people who want to deny rights is much smaller, but when they wield power, they can concentrate that power? And I think kids were asking natural questions, like, why is it hard to break down these power structures, and what would be the process to do that? And there's never any one perfect answer, because every situation is a little different. But that had me thinking about the conversation we were going to have today. And when you think, Dr. Hashimi, about the Taliban in power, as unpopular as they may be among many or most people in their own country, what do you see as a future in which they are no longer in power? What are the mechanisms and what are the steps?
That's a tough question, but I think the will of the Afghan people is reflected in the ongoing resistance that's happening. We've continued to see, and we've seen it since the Taliban came into power, but we've seen protests even into the streets of Afghanistan. And a protest in Afghanistan where women are coming out, men are sometimes coming out too. You saw at one school that men were walking out of the medical school campus in solidarity with their fellow classmates, women who were being barred from that classroom. That takes a lot of bravery in the setting of a Taliban regime where they have come in and you have an absolute awareness that many people have been detained, disappeared, interrogated, and beaten for being dissenting voices. So, and we have underground schools yet again happening in Afghanistan. So there's a resistance to that as well. There's resistance that comes up in many different shapes and forms. What is that? What's going to take to turn that into an actual toppling of this Taliban regime is really difficult. There have been armed resistance as well, particularly in the center of the country. But I don't know if this is going to come solely from an internal force, because it may need a little bit more pressure from the outside world. This might be a long, slow game that we're looking for. I don't think anything's going to happen in Afghanistan overnight, but I don't think that the suffocation of the people is really intolerable. And as much as people yearn for freedom, you have to counter that with the acknowledgement that the Taliban have an equally stronger, maybe even stronger, yearning for control of the country. And that's the grip they have right now.
Ellen, do you want to add to that? You agree with that?
I totally agree with that. And again, you know, we've talked about this a lot, Evan, that we saw it coming. I mean, we saw it coming. And, you know, when you do things like bring a couple or a woman out to be stoned to death in front of the village, it's you only need to harm one person to control everyone, because no one wants to go through that. But on the positive side, there are women and families risking their lives by having Zoom classes for their daughters, right? They're not going to be defeated. They're going to try to work around the system of lack of education. General Bradley, who was with us on the show exactly a year ago, is still running a school through the Lamia Foundation. So everyone is kind of trying to skirt around what the Taliban has done. And that is incredibly resilient. When we talk about, you know, resilient women, they are absolutely determined to learn.
Well, the event that's coming up is known as the Road to Resilience Gala. It is 2 weeks from tomorrow, April 18th. At Irondequoit
Country Club from 6 to 8 p.m.
Okay, so if you want to attend, you've got a week left to get tickets through the Keeping Our Promise website, Ellen, is that right?
Yep, keepingourpromise.org, and you go to events, and you'll see our Road to Resilience Gala.
Okay, yes. And so that's coming up in 2 weeks from tomorrow, and how would you describe the event for people who have not attended in the past?
You will get to meet our Afghan friends that we've resettled here in Rochester, and just meet incredibly strong women that have found their way here. And I am just so proud to know these women, to call them my sisters, and they're inspiring. Frohar is inspiring to me. The Afghan women, even if they did not work for the U.S., they have gone through so much and they are so determined. I see women sitting on the floor learning to read with their children, and I'm so proud of them. And they're learning to drive, and they're, you know, riding their bicycles from their apartments to Price Right to get groceries. I'm so proud of them and how far they've come.
Well, I want to bring the conversation to Frohar Askarzada, who... I'm going to give you some space, Frohar, to describe, but even before you got here to Rochester, what that path was like, what that time in Cyprus was like. But will you take me back to your upbringing and maybe some of your schooling and describe a little of the work that you had been doing in Afghanistan?
Yes, of course. Thank you for your question. Thank you for your question. I finished my school. I graduated from university, Islamic law in Afghanistan in Mazar-e-Sharif. So there was a one-year training under a founding by USAID that was just for women or girls who were graduating and seeking for jobs. Like, there was no jobs, or they can't find the proper job for themselves because they don't have a experience background for them. So it was a platform for them, and it was a bridge for them to find what they didn't find before. So I think it was beyond 1,000 girls attend this training, and 4 years they have, and they did a lot for the women in Afghanistan. It was in 5 provinces, I think. So that is why I'm here right now.
And I don't usually ask this question, but yep, there's a reason. So can I ask how old you are?
Yeah, I'm 33 years old.
33.
Yep.
And you heard Dr. Hashimi pointing out that the population of Afghanistan is young, meaning that there are many people, especially adults in their 20s and 30s,
yep,
who have grown up seeing the idea of the future for girls and women as one of choice, of work, of careers,
yes,
of opportunity.
Yes, of course.
So, but you're 33. Do you remember the Taliban's first time in power?
When the Taliban's come first, I think I was 6 or 7 years old. Mm-hmm. I don't really remember that, but I heard from my parents. Mm-hmm. They said when they came, it was like awful, like they are now. everything was banned, everything was shut. But what was the difference for the first and the second that they are now running it up? It was this, the new generation was under the government of very freedom. They had a freedom of speech. They had technologies. All of the girls, women were working, girls were going to school, colleges. But in the first time, it was like limited. But now that they are ruling, it is very ruining, especially women power. They have no right to work. They can go to schools. They can go to colleges. I have one in my own home, my sister. She just started going to college. When Taliban came, she's at home. And my mom afraid that she will be still at home if it's continued like this. She cannot she cannot find a proper job for herself. What should we do? What would be her future? So you can imagine if one is in my own house, and every house in Afghanistan, there are a lot of girls and women. I was working when Taliban came, but when Taliban came, I was in Afghanistan. But when Taliban came, the school shut down because I was a teacher. I was at home. I was used to work. But when I stayed at home and staring at the walls, I said to my mom, what can I do? What should I do? I tried a lot to do what I was doing, to reach out. But now what should I do? I was so upset. But it was a chance for me to get out of Afghanistan and living in Cyprus for 2 years and coming to America, resettling in Rochester, New York, and all because of USAID that was in Afghanistan, and that was what they were doing for girls and women. And why I'm in here and resettled in Rochester, just because of Ellen Smith and their all volunteer team, because they tried a lot to bring me here. It was as you said at your beginning, and every step we were getting to come here, it was like a wall coming in front of us. But Ellen Smith and their team was no, you can do that.
What Frohar told me on the phone yesterday, if you don't mind me saying this.
Yeah, no problem.
She said, Ellen Smith is an amazing woman. She is a pillar of my life.
I always tell that. She is a pillar of my life. And there is another woman I want to say thank you, a big thank you from me, my heart, and my family. It's Kim Schmidt. She stands from the beginning of anything I faced, anything my family faced. And Ellen Smith knows what I'm talking about. So I really want to thank Kim Schmidt. She's the one, the brilliant woman. And these two pillars are the pillars of Register. I know.
Well, what that ordeal entailed, let's talk a little bit about that. So before the Taliban came to power, you were teaching.
Yes.
What level were you teaching? How old?
High school.
High school.
Yes.
So we would call it, high school. That's a hard job.
It is a very hard job.
Did you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed my job. I chose that because I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. And how quickly, when the Taliban came to power, did that stop? Was it immediate?
I want to share that. In the morning, I woke up. My school starts at 8 a.m. I dressed up to school. It has a uniform. The school was 5 minutes afar from my home. I was just coming out of my home, and I was at the street walking and thinking by myself. I just saw it's different from the other mornings because it was nobody in the streets. Just I heard a sound from my bag calling my name. What are you doing in the street? I said, I'm going to attend my school. He said, you don't know what happened? I said, no, what's happening? Go back to your home. Taliban is on the door of Mazar. Everything is shut down. And that made me amazed for a minute. I was like this. He said, stop and I will let you lead to your home. I was just thinking, my home is just 1 minute far. How could he lead me? That comes in my mind now it's time to scare.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay, and so that was over. And so when you decided, you and your husband, and now you have a beautiful young baby.
Yes.
You're, in fact, everybody on this floor is like, who is that adorable baby?
Thank you.
He was born in October.
He was born in October. He was born in Cyprus.
And by then you were in Cyprus.
Yep.
And you were in Cyprus for about 2 years?
2 years.
Waiting for that final okay. But there were things that became complicated because your baby doesn't have a passport.
I want to like open this app. We were an asylum seeker in Cyprus. And asylum seekers are not allowed to get a passport from the country. So my baby was born there and they just gave him a birth certificate. That's it. But when they said bring his passport for the visa, each and every one of you needs a passport. We don't have our passport in our hands. It was with Cyprus government. So we gone through a lot to get our own passports and to like set up something for my baby to come out of Cyprus.
How close did you get sometimes thinking that you were going to be able to come here?
Yeah, twice we were in the airport near the boarding, but they said they are not allowing you because your baby does not have a passport. In the airport about to board.
Wow.
They said, we don't have a problem, but where you're going to be transit, that country will not allow your baby without a passport. We were like, oh. Then I came back to home. I talked to Ellen. She said, no, they don't have a right to do that because according to the law, when you have U.S. visa, you don't need any transit visas. And she was telling me, I was telling to them, they said, no, you need a transit visa and a passport for your baby.
Wow.
So it was a destiny that we should be here. So at the, I think 5 tickets, Ellen, you booked for us?
Yes.
Yeah, 5 tickets. And the last ticket was like a movie, like an adventure. She was on the phone with me.
2:30 in the morning here.
Yeah. My husband was on the phone with me. He was saying like they are not allowing us. Let's do Qatar Airlines. And she was like trying to book that ticket many times and it was going to fail. She said, oh, I successfully done your ticket by Qatar Airlines. And my husband said, oh, they allow us. So it happens.
Yeah. And I just want to interject here to give some background. We partner with Miles for Migrants, and they had gotten tickets for this family using frequent flyer miles. But the people at the airport would not let them go with the baby. But we had a document from the United States government that they were allowed to travel with their child. It's just that airlines wouldn't recognize it. So our fourth and fifth try were that we got another set of tickets from Miles for Migrants. They were saying they wouldn't let them board or travel to Germany. And so I booked out on Qatar Air with my personal credit card. And I'm telling the people at the airport, I'm on speakerphone saying, you have to let them go. They have their documents. And literally when I said, okay, that's it, we got the tickets from Qatar Air, go over to Qatar Air and you're going to travel through that country. And then the person behind the counter said, oh, they can go. So I quickly canceled the Qatar Air tickets, but it was insane.
Just and then, trying to find some route, yeah.
And then the other problem we had was when they picked up their passports from the Cyprus government to get their U.S. visas, the Cyprus government then gave them only 10 days to leave or to be deported back to their country of origin. So when I say it was like a movie to get them out, it really was like a movie.
I want to add one other point in here. I don't know why Cyprus does not know what are SIVs. When we say it's a visa, they said, from where you got an American visa? We said, I'm a SIV. What is SIV? So I don't know. I was in shock why they don't know who are SIVs.
It shouldn't be Frohar's job to educate a foreign government on an immigration and visa law. But this is just a glimpse into how difficult the process can be and, frankly, how much work is required on behalf of organizations, individuals like Ellen, If you're just joining us, Ellen Smith is, of course, with Keeping Our Promise and keepingourpromise.org for more information there, or for tickets to the upcoming gala fundraiser, which is 2 weeks from tomorrow. And Frohar Askerzada, you finally got here. January?
19th January.
January 19th. And how were you feeling when you finally got to Rochester?
Oh, my God. When we finally said, like, I text her, we got the tickets. And now we are getting in the airplane to Germany. I feel really relaxed. And when I landed here, at first I saw my brother after 7 years. And it was amazing.
Frohar's brother has been in Rochester for 7 years. Came out on SIV as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. So it was like, thanks to Ellen Smith, she really helped all SIVs here to resettle in a very good environment and a very good community, friendly. And I'm so glad to be here.
Well, there's a few notes that I made in my conversation with Frohar that I want to ask you to talk about
a little bit.
So Frohar and her husband and her baby's doing great.
Yeah.
Have been here now for just over 2 months, 2.5 months. And there is a vibrant Afghan community here. How much has that helped you?
It helped me a lot because at the first, when I was in Cyprus, it the first, like, shocked me because there was no Afghans. There was, like, literally very few Afghans and far from each other. But when I go out, when I see my own people, I am in U.S., yes, but I am not far from my culture, far from my people. And this makes me happy. This makes me so relaxed. Mm.
And you said that when you spent those couple years in Cyprus, they didn't know what Ramadan was.
Yes. I want to tell a very funny maybe story.
Okay.
My husband was working there, and it was month of Ramadan. He said to his boss, okay, my fasting starts from tomorrow, and it's for 13 days. If you can, give me less job. Because I'm fasting the whole day. He said, why you're fasting? Are you nuts? Why you're fasting? What is that? You are not going to drink? You're not going to? He said, no, from the morning till evening, I'm not, my mouth is like nothing. He said, dude, you're crazy. He came to home and he was letting me know what happened that day. I said, okay, they don't know what's the culture of Afghan people or what's the culture of Muslims. So let it be, go and do your job, have your fast. So they don't know anything.
Do you feel that here that your culture is better understood?
Very better understood. I was in a car with an American woman, they help us to go for groceries. Mm-hmm. And it was our new year, not even Ramadan. It was our new year. It's come just a week before. She said to me, happy new year. I was, oh, you know, this is our new year. She said, yes, we know everything of Afghanistan. I said, oh my God, I'm so happy. I was missing my family, that nobody is saying to me, happy new year. And she suddenly said to me from a different culture, country, and I was so happy. I said to my husband, see, it's different.
I should warn you, Frohar, I think you will encounter Americans who don't know when your new year is. There may be some.
Maybe.
Okay. But it has been a pretty comfortable couple of months so far, it sounds like.
It was very comfortable, yeah.
Yeah. And now, you know, Frohar's here. Frohar has a law degree, teacher. Your husband's an engineer?
Yeah, he's an engineer.
And so, he's going to work on his language. He's wants to work. You want to work. What does the future look like for you, do you think?
I'm looking my future very bright. Not only mine, my whole family's future. My husband's future. He's very happy that he can enjoy building his future here like a businessman. He really wants to do that. And because in Cyprus it was limited for us for mm-hmm. jobs, we cannot go to attend college, attend universities or something like this. We just sit in a home, few limited jobs, cleaning, these kinds of things. So in here, when he sees his future, he's so happy. And I'm happy too, because I know with my own baby, whenever he is big, he can do his best here. And I'm happy for myself But on the other hand, I'm thinking about the others who are still in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I know we can't bring each and everyone here. It's a big country. It's a big population. So, but my dream is for them is that I want them to be before when the government was not like this, when US was there, the environment was so good. I was under US, I grown up under US government there. So I know they are missing those days.
And Dr. Hashemi's family went through the same thing, as I recall.
Doctor, you want to pick up that story?
Sure. You know, I think, unfortunately, we have generations of Afghans who have had the story of being forcibly displaced by conflict from their homeland. And there's a lot of tragedy that's buried in that. There's a lot of hurt and grief and loss in those stories and in that family legacy. But on the flip side, we also have so many stories of triumph and of resurrection. And that's what's happened within my own family. My parents came to this country actually just before the conflict, but I've seen uncles and aunts and grandparents flee decades of conflict in Afghanistan and come here or go to other countries and become engineers, become doctors, become business owners, become people who contribute to communities. And my husband as well. He and his family were as refugees in Europe before getting accepted to rejoin family members here in the United States. And he's today a physician, as are several of his siblings, everyone contributing to the economy and helping taking care of people in our communities as well. So there is so much light at the end of the tunnel if we can get through it.
Can I ask you to describe what goes through your mind when you hear a story like Frohar's?
I'm so moved by her story. I'm so happy for her and for her family. I think, you know, what a different story is being written for them just because of this opportunity to be here and because of the opportunities that were available to her, to her family members while they were there in Afghanistan. And just like Frohar is saying, it's so hard not to think about the millions that are left behind. And as much as we would want a different future for them, I think it cannot be here in the United States for everyone. And that's where we've got to be very diligent about, you know, what does our foreign policy look like with regards to the Taliban? How much of a blessing are we giving them to run a gender apartheid regime, a completely misogynistic regime that does not respect human rights in the least? And what can be done to honor the promises that were made to the remaining SIVs that are not yet here? Because, you know, we had an additional 12,000 visas that were authorized recently, but that number was supposed to be 20,000. And so, you know, the advocacy work of Afghan American Foundation, of Wartime Allies, of so many veterans groups, and just so many organizations that have their eye on this and understand exactly how important it is to these families, it must continue.
We have to take our only break this hour, and we're going to come right back, and we're going to spend the next 20 minutes talking a little bit more about what you just heard there. Sometimes it's a promise that isn't always kept. Keeping Our Promise is the name of Ellen Smith's organization, but this country has often put numbers of a plan to bring 20,000, and then all of a sudden it's 12,000, and there's a plan to speed up the SIV process, and yet people are waiting for years, and sometimes their lives are threatened. You're hearing these remarkable stories, and we'll come right back with them next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, our first opportunity to sit down with Johnny Vega, a native of Puerto Rico who came to Rochester in 1970, he has become a salsa music pioneer. Next month, he'll be inducted into the Rochester Music Hall of Fame. And while he's big here, he is even bigger around the globe. And we're going to talk to Johnny about this remarkable life and career next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You know, we've been talking to Frohar Oscarzada, and if you're not listening to Connections for the first time today, you might have heard conversations with SIVs in the past. We put a lot of work and take a lot of pride into making sure we understand these stories and we hear them at length. Modern media, modern news coverage is pretty fast and short. This is a chance to hear these stories at length and you understand the plights and the ordeals that families have faced to get here to Rochester, and then what their lives are like here, and then what they need and organizations like Keeping Our Promise need, and what the UF Afghan Women's Council needs and the Afghan American Foundation. For you, Frohar, your family, you know, every time I've asked you how you're doing, you start to smile. And I know that in so many ways, you're doing well. But I'm curious to know what you think you still need or what is the biggest struggle for you so far, 2.5 months into your life in the United States.
What I still need here is my family.
You need your family.
Yep.
Hold on. Ellen and Frohar are trading some notes here. That's okay. But when you say your family,
yep.
Tell me more about that.
My parents and my little sister is still in Afghanistan. My father worked in government. He was a police officer. So I'm still worried about them. But if I see my future here, I really need a car. Because it's a big city. Transportation is very important. When you work somewhere, you really need to have your own car. Not only me, I think every new family who arrives here and anywhere, they need a very good transportation for themselves. Like if me or my husband finds a job, if you use bus, it will be like tired. It could make us tired even before starting our own jobs.
Okay, so transportation's a big one. Where would they get a car, Ellen Smith?
Well, we have had for 8 years of our 10, this is, by the way, this is our 10th anniversary. We're 10 years now.
Yeah.
But we've had a Wheels to Work car grant program. And under that program, a family would have to work 100 hours in community service back to the community. And we would help them get their driver's license. We have the New York State driver's manual in Pashto and Dari. And for their 100 hours, they would get a $3,000 grant, which would give them a down payment for a car, their insurance payment, and registration. Unfortunately, that because of funding, that car grant program is now on hold. We just can't afford that with all the families coming in. And we're looking for foundation support for that program. And a car is important. Rochester's average commute time one way to work is 90 minutes, the way the bus system works. And if you want to take a part-time job, it's really impossible to do that when you're relying on the bus. You really do need a car. And our families with cars, like during COVID, they were the backbone. They were the Grubhub drivers. They were DoorDash. They were doing the Amazon deliveries to everybody's houses. And they continue to do that work now and using that money to help support their families back in Afghanistan as well.
When Ellen says 90 minutes is the commute, we're talking about families who don't have a car of their own. And when you think about living in a place like Rochester where everyone says, well, everything is 20 minutes or less. You can get anywhere in 20 minutes or less. That's the privilege of having a car.
That's impossible.
Don't say
20 minutes.
No.
When I want to go somewhere, I Google that place and it shows me by bus 1 hour with my 5-month-old son traveling in one day in 4 buses, 2 for going and 2 for coming, and just 1 hour for going, 1 hour for coming, and do your what you want. It takes 4 hours at least, and it's a lot.
Yeah, and so the idea of 20 minutes or less is for people who have the advantage of having a car of their own.
Right.
And so that's a challenge, and so there's one idea. So that means Keeping Our Promise needs money. Everybody needs money.
Everybody needs money.
That's also why the big event is coming up here. If you want to get tickets to and go to the annual gala fundraiser, meet Ellen, who is the pillar of our community.
Yep.
Like Frohar keeps saying, yes, pillar.
Yes.
Frohar's not the only one who has said so. That is 2 weeks from tomorrow night. It's at Irondequoit Country Club. You can buy tickets until next Wednesday, but I wouldn't wait to do that. You can go to keepingourpromise.org if you are interested there. Let me ask Dr. Nadia Hashimi what the organizations that you have been a member of, what you think they need, the U.S. Afghan Women's Council, the Afghan American Foundation, what do you think they need?
Well, what really helps us the most is the partnership of other individuals, because it's one thing for the Afghan American Foundation to stand up and say that we need to keep our promise and honor the promise that was made to the individuals who qualify for this special immigration visa. But it's quite another to have the added voices and the synergy of other organizations and individuals. So I would say, you know, one thing that's really powerful to do is to make sure that people are using the opportunity that we have to express our opinions, contact representatives, your state representatives, and make sure that Congress knows where we stand. The most impactful work is really being done on the ground by organizations and by individuals like the ones who are part of Keeping Our Promise. Locally here in my area in Maryland, we've seen organizations, houses of faith of all kinds coming together to help stock new apartments, to welcome families with a warm meal, to teach someone to drive, to make sure that they know how to get their kids registered into schools. And that is the kind of stuff that's so empowering, that really gives a family wings so that they get off on the right start when they come here to a new country. As you can all imagine, how intimidating a process that is.
Talking to Dr. Nadia Hashimi, who is both a pediatrician and author. And as an author, maybe we ought to have a separate conversation with you, if I can convince you sometime, doctor, to come on and talk about the literary work that you have done. And can I just ask you briefly to tell our listeners about that and why you've chosen that kind of tangent in your career?
Sure. I mean, I think I write the stories in retrospect now that I wish I would have found on the shelves when I was a kid, digging through the stacks and spending my summers at the local library. I've been an avid reader my entire life, and I love stories because of how much they teach me and how they transport me and connect me with other people. And yet I never found stories on the shelves that reflected the Afghan stories, the types of tales and legends that were discussed in our home or talked about at the kitchen table. So I write stories that are based on what the Afghan people have gone through, that include bits of our culture that can be hopefully preserved on the shelf. And I write the stories that I hope will inform people that the Afghan story is more than one of tragedy. It's also one of humor, of resilience, of overcoming, of love, of color, of music. And I hope that people will understand that that's also what's coming here. It's an appreciation for life and a sense of a family that I think will really add a lot to the American community too.
What's the name of your latest book, Doctor?
My latest book is Sparks Like Stars, and that talks about the 1978 military coup that happened in Afghanistan. So this, you know, I write fiction, but really so much of it is inspired by the truth of what's happened. And sometimes the stories of people that I've seen coming here to the United States in the last couple of years have been like these stories kind of jumping off the pages and coming to life.
Well, consider this an open invitation. When I get caught up on reading your work, I'd love to have you back sometime to do that, because I
appreciate it. My pleasure.
Absolutely. Okay. And I want to turn to Frohar. I mean, I'm thinking about how powerful a piece of literature can be. And listeners might have heard me invoke this before. This is, I don't know if there's a single line in a novel that I've ever seen that has affected me the way Khaled Hosseini's in The Kite Runner, the line, "There are a lot of children in Afghanistan, but little childhood." And that is a heartbreaking line in one single devastating line that is not only true, but depicts, I think, for those of us who live in a place of abundance and advantage, a description of how different life can be when there is suffering. When you think about your own son now, 5, 6 months old, what do you think about his future?
Mm-hmm. And here,
yeah,
it's very bright, his future. He can do anything, what he wants. Like, he can get a doctor. He can do anything in his life, anything he wants to do. But if I go back to my own country, I lived there like 30 years. I know. When I go to like shopping in the streets, there are child like 4 years, 5 years. As you said, they are child, but they lost their childhood. Why? Because they are selling plastics. They are selling out things out there. I can't compare them to like children who grown ups here. Mm-hmm. It's very, as I told you, we can do like we can bring everyone here. We have to do something for our country.
I did have one question from a listener, and then I want to turn back to Ellen before we lose the hour here. One listener was asking, are there Afghan people who support the Taliban? I mean, I guess if you're a member of the Taliban, perhaps. Do you know any Afghan women who support the Taliban? I mean, that's a very strange question, but do you know any?
I want to, like, say this question, like, answer it like this. I'm not a very news person.
Okay, sure.
Yep. I'm not a really news person. Why I don't see news? Because when I see, I got upset.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not asking you to speak for an entire country. I'm just asking if you know any Afghan women who support the Taliban.
Because where I grown up, it was all educated women. So I don't say anything like that.
Do you know men who support the Taliban?
I said they were all educated men, mm-hmm. women around me. Mm-hmm. They all want their country to be free from violence. So I really don't know.
Yeah. And Ellen, there was a family that you wanted to mention as well before the hour was up as
well. Yeah, two things. We're focusing on the resilience of women in our gala. And also, I just want to put a plug in. I'm not going to name last names, but one of our volunteers, Deb, she worked on a case for 6 years. That young man whose case she worked on, they were separated. He was separated from his family. He's going to be coming next week to Rochester. And Frohar mentioned Kim, who worked on her case. And I also want to mention Judy, that has helped countless numbers in visa advocacy cases, who are our volunteers. I do want to mention there's a family that I'm working with right now. It's the drone strike family. Zamari Ahmadi was killed mistakenly by the U.S., himself, two other adults, and seven children. His brother, Ajmal, is here in Rochester. We have been asking the U.S. government to please get them out of Afghanistan, survivors. This would be Ajmal's wife's father, brother, and family who were there at the drone strike on the news, first accused being part of ISIL when we said that we were targeting an ISIL family. And then, of course, it came out on the news that this family worked for the United States. And so now they're targeted because they worked for the United States. And that's a case that I'm working on with an attorney down in D.C. And I just want people to understand the complexity of things we're working on and what we do behind the scenes besides just help our Afghan friends resettle in Rochester.
Are you optimistic that
I am lost. I am lost at why this family is not here, why they weren't on the list of people to be relocated after Afghanistan.
Especially after the suffering.
Yes, yes. And and we have to make it right. As a country, as a community, me as an American citizen, I feel very strongly that we have to do right by this family, and we need to get them out of Afghanistan and here to the United States. And in particular, the group that I'm working with, I want them here in Rochester to be reunited with their family here.
All right, Ellen, one more time. Dr. Nadia Hashimi is going to be part of your event. You've got a lot coming up in a couple of weeks. Tickets will be on sale for one more week if people want to go to Keeping Our Promises annual event I think it's a wonderful theme, the Road to Resilience Gala fundraiser. Want to tell people a little bit more about it? Go ahead.
Yeah, we're celebrating women this year and the resilience of Afghan women, how proud we are of them and what they've done and what they will do for our Rochester community.
Wonderful. That's October, April 18th, 2 weeks from tomorrow at Irondequoit Country Club, keepingourpromise.org. And let me close by asking Frohar, you know, I mean, many places in the world, many cities in the world, if you grew up in that city, you have a lot of pride, but you also can be a little negative or tough about your city or, you know, maybe not see its beauty, maybe not see all of the opportunity. You are not from Rochester originally, to say the least. Rochester is very different than from Mazar-i-Sharif, but here you are with your family. How would you describe Rochester to people who have not been here?
As you said, I came here just 2.5 months, but I know Rochester's about 7 years because my brother was here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very familiar to here. For that reason, I chose here, and because Ellen Smith organization is here, and I know they helped a lot for SIVs. They do a lot for SIVs. I got my permit, and I'm waiting to get my driving license, and it's a big, big achievement for me. And they do a lot. As I told you, it's been 7 years I know register. I would not choose anywhere else to go.
Wonderful. You feel safe here?
Really safe.
Very safe.
Yeah.
And your son's going to grow up here, and we're glad that you are here. And I'm
Thank
glad
you.
To meet you here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frohar. I really appreciate the conversation. And to your whole family, I wish you the very, very best.
Thank you so much.
Rochester is better because you're here. That's Frohar Oscarzada. And her family is here. Frohar's on an SIV, and it's through organizations like Keeping Our Promise that it's happening. Ellen Smith, thank you as always.
Thank you, Evan.
Much love to you. And I want to thank Dr. Nadia Hashimi, who has been with us this hour, a pediatrician, an author, member of the U.S. Afghan Women's Council and the Afghan American Foundation. Dr. Hashimi, a wonderful first conversation. I look forward to the next one.
Many thanks.
And we've got much more connections coming up in just a moment.